Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Consider this list: smartphones, computers, non-glare glass, LEDs, wind turbines, and the list of where rare earth elements are found goes on and on. Two University of North Dakota researchers were recently awarded a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to study the possibility of recovering rare earth elements from North Dakota's lignite coal, and this could lead to a major new industry for the state. From the University of North Dakota Institute of Energy Studies, we visit with and welcome Senior Research Manager Nolan Thaker to Main Street. Nolan, how are you?
Doing pretty well, and glad to be on the show.
We're glad that you're here, Nolan. Let's define what rare earth elements are for our guests, if we could start there.
So rare earth elements, the rare part's actually a bit of a misnomer. They're actually relatively common. They just don't typically appear in big mineral deposits like you'd find a copper vein or an iron vein. And it's a group of about 17 different elements. It's, if you can take a look at the periodic table, it's the lanthanide series and the elements directly above those. And the reason why they're grouped together is chemically they're very similar, and they also all occur together. Typically, you don't find one of these elements apart from the other.
Nolan, if you look at the history of rare earth elements and how they were produced, you can't help but recognize the United States used to be a leader in this. In fact, the Mountain Pass mine in California was a significant source of rare earth elements during the 60s through the 80s or so. But now China controls the market. Why is that?
So there's a few reasons historically. One, the which rare earth elements we use has changed over time. In the 60s through the 80s, the rare earth elements for making certain ceramics and pigments and different glasses were really the primary use of them. But now that's kind of shifted to the magnet rare earths, and those aren't some of the Mountain Pass some of the rare earths that you need for magnets aren't really found in Mountain Pass. They're found in other resources. They have two of the major elements, neodymium and praseodymium, but they don't have some of the other ones. Now, ultimately, China found a resource with some of those heavy rare earth elements for magnets, and so obviously them producing that obviously led to a significant uptake there. But a lot of the reason why the U.S. didn't produce them for the longest time was, to my knowledge, an offshoring of kind of environmental responsibility. The separation of these rare earth elements can be pretty chemically intensive, can take a lot of chemicals, and not all of them are pretty nice chemicals. It can be some real nasties. And ultimately, us offshoring some of that separation to China and them being willing to pick that up allowed them to basically slowly dominate the market worldwide.
So have those environmental concerns and hurdles been refined to the extent that now maybe we can do this again in the United States more carefully?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been significant improvement in the technology and how we separate rare earths. Even in China, to give them credit where it's due, they've done a much better job in recent history, the last 5 years, in the environmental space and rare earths than they have previously. But what we're looking for is, in essence, as environmentally friendly a process as possible to, in essence, minimize the potential environmental risks from this, rare earth processing.
Sure. So you now have been granted a significant grant to study this and extracting rare earth elements from lignite coal. What are the challenges that you are up against in order to do this efficiently, for only not only cost efficiently but also environmentally efficiently?
So this isn't actually our first grant in the territory. This is, I think, our sixth at this point, looking at extracting rare earths from lignite. And so we've kind of already figured out technically how it's going to happen, what the economic drivers to make it feasible or not feasible are, and some of those environmental problems. But this grant is really tuning in on actually designing a commercial facility, looking at the permits that we would have to be required, and actually, in essence, drafting those permits for that facility to be built. And then ultimately the sort of procedure and how that facility is going to be operated. This grant is actually a phased grant. This phase one, that $10 million, is for doing that design and that environmental work. And phase two would actually be building the facility and operating it. And so it's pretty much right up against the doorstep of what we need to do to make this real.
Give us an idea of the potential economic impact for North Dakota.
So the potential economic impact, I mean, this plant that we're proposing is going to produce hundreds of tons of rare earths. If you think of a rare earth, on average per ton, it's probably in the hundreds of thousands of dollars that it's valued at. So obviously that plant is selling tens to potentially even hundreds of millions worth of dollars of product. But more importantly, this now puts North Dakota in a very unique spot where it's a state that's producing these elements. Now, there's a giant value supply chain and value chain right behind this where we then refine this out into the individual elements. You could then make these into metals. You could then make these into magnets. You could then build manufacturing that uses those magnets for wind turbines or electric vehicle motors or a host of other things. And so this is really an enabling technology and an enabling process that once we have this resource present in North Dakota, we're hoping to actually bring in a lot more industry afterwards.
Give us an idea of a potential timeline for a project this massive.
So per the DOE's timeline, ultimately we're looking at we'd be starting construction of a facility like this in 2025. So just about a year and a half down the road at this point. I'd expect 2 to 3 years to actually build and commission it, and then we'd be operating before the end of the decade for certain. Then, in essence, how many of those supply chain additions get bolted on after that, that kind of has yet to be seen, and those are individual companies that make that decision. But presumably, where you have a product that you can't find elsewhere, people start coming to it.
Is the place where the extraction might occur and then the place where the extracted mineral will be refined different places or the same place geographically?
So they can be different places. So the place in where the extraction has to occur pretty much has to be at the mine site. We're talking about extracting from large quantities of lignite. Lignite's 40% water. It doesn't make sense to just ship water around.
Nolan, where in North Dakota are we talking about?
This grant is looking at the Center Mine near Center, North Dakota, and then the Falkirk Mine around Underwood, North Dakota.
So then you would anticipate the refinement of those minerals to be in those areas as well?
For this grant, kind of because we're kind of leveraging off of some other work that's been done, the refining as of right now is being projected to head down to Nebraska. That's where Rare Earth Salts LLC is located, and they've done rare earth refining in the past. But ultimately, it could be elsewhere in North Dakota. It could be in another state. At that point, we're talking about only shipping a few hundred tons around. So it is relatively easy to ship around. But our presumption or our hope would be that North Dakota looks like a very obvious spot to stick it with attractive business regulation, attractive power pricing, and, of course, the existence of the feedstock itself.
Visiting with Nolan Thaker from the University of North Dakota, he's a senior research manager, and we are discussing a grant that has been obtained by the university to study rare earths and perhaps refining them from lignite coal here in North Dakota. What do we know about extracting rare earths from coal, and why is this considered potentially one of the more sustainable ways to do it?
So there's a few different answers to that. First, we're already mining the coal. We don't have to disturb new land, and we don't have to get a new mining permit that's going to take 10 to 15 years to do it. We could do that right off the bat from the existing mines. Second, the way the rare earths are bound in the coal, they're not in these basically hard rock minerals. They're actually very loosely bound in the coal. And so extracting it is just contacting this porous sponge-like coal that lignite is with some acid, washing stuff off the surface of that sponge, and then in essence collecting that liquid somewhere else after you filter the coal out. So it's a very simple, very environmentally friendly because we're not using harsh chemicals process. And those are two of the major reasons we think it's valuable. The third major reason is after you extract these rare earths out, you can still use the coal. And it's actually better for burning. It's better for making other carbon products out of. The coal is still usable and actually better used after we extract than before.
When you say it's better, is it lower sulfur content? Is that the reason why?
There's a little bit lower sulfur content. One of the major problems in North Dakota boilers is sodium. There's a lot of sodium in the coals, and it creates fouling on the boiler and makes everything less efficient. And then they have to have outages for cleaning. Our process, in essence, removes all of the sodium, which obviously is a huge impact on that cleaning and that efficiency of those boiler walls. And also it helps by removing sodium. It makes it some of the problems that you can face looking at CO2 capture, such as sodium aerosols working their way through your boiler and then fouling your capture fluid. Those problems go away if you extract that sodium before. So it makes it a little bit better for CO2 capture, more the boiler cleaner operating and more efficient. And it removes some of those contaminants like sulfur, although less so.
Give us a 30,000-foot view of how this will impact the coal industry in general. And I guess the specific question I'm asking is most do not think that the extraction of rare earth elements from coal is in and of itself a way to save the industry as people move to greener sources of energy. Is that true?
I would almost argue that it is true in that it's not in and of itself. It's not the silver bullet. We're not going to start extracting rare earths from coal and say, coal is saved. We don't have to worry about anything else ever again. Where I think it is valuable and the real ammunition comes in is those enabling benefits on this makes CO2 capture cheaper, more efficient, better. This makes your boiler more efficient and better. This product, after you extract the rare earths, you can make pretty high quality carbon products like activated carbon for capturing pollutants, like fertilizer for fertilizing soils, like a number of other things. And it's a more efficient, higher quality product than it was before. I think that's where it helps. So I don't see rare earths being all coal mines turn into only rare earths mine and they don't have to worry about the coal anymore. But what I do see it doing is, in essence, stabilizing and helping address some concerns and near-term and long-term concerns with the coal industry.
What do we know about limitations or drawbacks to the recovery and refining of rare earth elements from lignite coal?
So not all the rare earths can be extracted. Ultimately, the coal doesn't just act as a sponge for rare earths. They act as a sponge for just about every element. And so we have to kind of pick and choose how much rare earths do we want to get out versus how much of these impurities that I then have to process do I get. And so there's kind of a game you have to play where you don't get all the rare earths, but you get enough and you don't get as much impurities as you see elsewhere. So that's one restriction. Another restriction is just the quality of the rare earths. The amount of rare earths and what type of rare earths are in the coal. If you have the really valuable magnet rare earths and in strong abundance, obviously that's going to be a very, very profitable coal, and that's one you're going to want to go after. Not all coals are like that, and so we have to be specific about which resources we look at and which ones we ignore based on rare earth content as well as rare earth type.
You have noted that West Virginia University and West Virginia have also applied for federal funds to compete for this process. Is this going to be one or the other, one winner, or will there potentially be two facilities like you've described?
As it stands from the DOE language they've put out right now, it appears that they're going only with one facility. But I personally think that that's kind of a problem. I think both facilities have advantages and disadvantages. The West Virginia facility looking at acid mine drainage is going to help treat acid mine drainage, which is obviously a plus, and it'll produce some rare earths. But the rare earths they get out and some of the rare earths and critical minerals we get out, they're not the same ones. And so there is space for both plants to exist in my eyes. I see a acid mine drainage plant producing some rare earths And then our plant, for instance, lignite contains germanium and gallium, which are semiconductor metals, which are really, really important in LEDs, fiber optics, transistors for computers, stuff like that. Those aren't in acid mine drainage. And so obviously that a plant like ours could still produce some of those elements and in essence not compete with the acid mine drainage plant. But that's for the government to decide.
Are there other states in the race too, or is it coming down to relative to extracting rare earths from coal, it's going to be either West Virginia or North Dakota?
For this specific opportunity, it's just West Virginia and North Dakota that's really in the race. They have released another notice of intent where they want to solicit additional projects looking at these engineering design studies for other rare earths and critical minerals from coal and coal byproduct processes. And so I'm certain we're going to have a few other entities apply to those. But as of right now, for this specific grant and the DOE-funded commercial plant that's coming from it, it appears it's just UND and West Virginia at this point.
On the confidence scale, how confident are you that UND will prevail here?
I would love to say I'm hugely confident and that UND is just the greatest. But West Virginia's technology is good too, and obviously there's political concerns associated with it as well. For the project itself, I believe UND's team is really strong. We have massive industry support from all levels, including the refiners, processors, and purchasers of rare earths, to coal companies, power plants, and plenty of other industries who'd be involved. And I think that helps us significantly. Additionally, we have massive support from the state, both from the Lignite Research Program as well as just the state in general. And so I think those things certainly help us out. But in terms of are we going to win or not, that's yet to see on what we find in this project and then what DOE's decision is based on that.
And how will you know? I mean, and when will you know, do you believe?
So this design project and design effort will wrap up before the end of 2024. And then DOE will have a 6-month period where they will ultimately be reviewing the two projects and then making a decision, once again, as it stands, on which one of the two will be moving forward. And so we'd be expecting sometime early 2025 when they would make that decision. And that's when that construction of that plant would begin.
Give us an idea of the amount of lignite coal deposits here versus elsewhere in the country.
So in terms of the amount of lignite in North Dakota, it's just an absolutely tremendous amount in North Dakota. Just in the economically mineable resources, a.k.a. the resources that can be mined at essentially the exact same price we mine today, we've got 800 years of current supply, or somewhere in the neighborhood of a few billion tons of lignite. If we are able to pay a bit more to mine that lignite, it goes up to 1 trillion tons. To me, an unfathomable amount of material. There's also lignite in the Gulf Coast and lignite in Alaska. And there's plenty of other coal elsewhere. But in terms of just a singular deposit, North Dakota stands out in the United States in that way.
And as we wrap up our conversation, are there other projects in North Dakota using different methods that are also trying to attack this rare earth element shortage of production here in the United States, or is this kind of the one?
So, I mean, there's been other projects. The Energy Environmental Research Center at UND, they've had a project on attempting to extract the rare earths from coal fly ash after it's been burned. There's also been projects looking at or some investigation on can we extract this in the coal actually before you dig it out of the ground and just while it's still in the ground. And there's been some investigation into some recycling efforts. But in terms of what's farthest along, I think this coal-based process is what is farthest along. And it's, once again, just a few years from us breaking ground on a commercial plant at this point.
Well, best wishes to you and your work.
Thank you very much. And hoping to come back here a couple of years from now and talk about how the plant's coming up.
We'll look forward to that. Nolan Thaker is a senior research manager at the University of North Dakota Institute for Energy Studies. Nolan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Natural North Dakota is next.
Continuing the family line that includes Father Tom and late Uncle Harry, the harmonizing folk duo The Chapin Sisters are back with their first album in 5 years, and we've got them live on the next Great American Folk Show.
Will the streets recognize my feet?
I'm Tom Brusseau. You'll also enjoy the country-tinged folk of Jess Williamson.
The difference between us is when I sing it, I really mean it.
Plus music from Sean Marshall and Annie Sandral of Three Sisters Flower Farm will be on the show. And Fargo chef Summer Peterson shares a creamy tomato soup recipe good for any season. The Great American Folk Show, Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. A lot of people over Memorial Day weekend will be heading out and working in the garden. Here is biologist Chuck Lura with this week's Natural North Dakota essay on landscaping and gardening with native plants.
Have you ever heard of the Wild Ones? No, it's not some motorcycle movie from the 1950s or 60s. This Wild Ones is a group of people interested in gardening and landscaping with native plants. The vision and value statement of the Wild Ones states in part that they, and I quote here, strive to become a widely recognized voice for native plants and the sustainable landscaping movement, promoting increased use of native plantings that create living landscapes through grassroots efforts by example, education, marketing, and personalized support, unquote. Our landscapes are changing, and that change generally involves the loss of native habitats, such as our native prairie and woodlands. As such, the abundance and distribution of the native plants and the myriad of animals, for example, pollinators, insects, birds, etc., that are dependent on native plants are increasingly being reduced and fragmented. Many beneficial insects, for example, are dependent on some variety of native plants for cover, larval food, and nectar, and other foods for the adults. Gardening and landscaping with native plants can provide aesthetically pleasing environments, provide plants for native pollinators, reduce our carbon footprint, help preserve native biodiversity, and produce more environmentally sound and sustainable landscapes. And, of course, they can help ensure the viability of the many of our native plants and animal species in both urban and rural environments. And our native plants will not become future nuisance or noxious weeds. Most people look at domesticated plants for garden and landscaping use, but give some consideration to utilizing native plants. Even though you may not completely revamp your lawn or garden to natives, you may choose to incorporate some native plants in your design. I've put a link to the Wild Ones website, as well as links to other information on gardening and landscaping with native plants, including some links specific to North Dakota, along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Get tips for road tripping the West Coast on the inland routes.
You want to use I-5 when you want to make good time, and take the old roads if you want to have a good time.
And hear how they're keeping traditions alive in the folk music of Scotland.
We really love a very sad song.
And in the quirky community games of England.
And one of the highlights is shin kicking.
It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Still to come on Main Street, a look at why Indigenous women go missing or are found murdered at roughly 10 times the national average. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Members of the Republican Party will be among those potentially taking to the social media platform Twitter tonight in anticipation of an announcement that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is launching his bid for the presidency. North Dakota Republican Party Chairman Perry Schaefer says having a crowded stage is a good situation to have.
There's a good reason for us to be happy about that, because I guess there's a lot of different points of view now that can come to the surface. And then as the state of North Dakota and as the United States, we can decide who we want to be and to be in leadership through the primary process.
Perry says the challengers have an uphill battle. He says former President Donald Trump carries strong numbers in the national polls, and he's still highly favored here in North Dakota.
Trump certainly has fantastic points with respect to how he leads. There's no question about that. But I think the more people that enter the race, I think that's good because it gives them a chance to get up on stage and delineate their differences and how they would lead our country, which would reflect on our state either the same or differently.
The North Dakota GOP will make their endorsement decisions at the party's state convention next spring. And Strengthen ND is working on getting their small farm incubator up and running. Megan Langley is Strengthen ND's executive director and says the incubator is a way for them to encourage those interested in farming to try it out on a small scale. Each participant will work with about an acre of land, growing specialty crops such as onions, carrots, and tomatoes.
What we're really hoping to do is to take in a small number of potential farmers every year, up to five who will be working with us on that space and beginning to launch their own small farm. So we will work with those five over the period of 2 to 3 years to build their skills, to get a couple of years of growing experience under their belt, and to be able to sell their products at farmers markets or to institutions or to other buyers, so that they can start to get that cash flow going.
Langley says the program will start taking applications for the first group in November. She hopes to start moving the first cohort through the incubator curriculum in January of 2024.
We intend to launch a value-added ag manufacturing accelerator where we bring together people throughout the local foods ecosystem to make those connections between or among local foods producers, consumers, and those who are interested in really vertically integrating agricultural products throughout our state. And we will also have a land link program, which will help for long-term sustainability of small farming, where we will continue to link new farmers or farmers who are looking to exit farming or otherwise retire, so that more of that farming tradition can be passed down across generations.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. In the summer of 2017, 22-year-old Savannah LaFontaine Graywind vanished. Known by her Dakota name, Where Thunder Finds Her, her body was later found in the Red River. She'd been brutally murdered and her baby ripped from her womb. This is one example of the unspeakable violence that faces many Indigenous women. We are going to be visiting now with the author of the book Searching for Savannah, The Murder of One Native American Woman and the Violence Against the Many, Mona Gable. Mona, thank you so much for joining us today.
So happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
How did you first hear about the story of Savannah? This is one of the rare cases where something that happens to an Indigenous person at many times, up to 10 times the national average, did catch fire and make national attention.
Well, I was, I've written a lot about domestic violence as a journalist over the past 2.5 decades. And at the same time, I was starting to look into my Indigenous ancestry in Oklahoma. My grandmother was a member of the Chickasaw tribe, and I have a lot of cousins in Oklahoma who were becoming tribal members and registering with the tribe. And so I just became really excited about that. And the two events kind of coalesced together because I was looking for a story to write about Native American women. And I came across, in my research, I came across Savannah's story. And I was just immediately captivated by it, not because of the circumstances of her murder, but because of who she was, and she didn't fit the stereotype of the victim that has been sort of perpetuated about Native American women who disappear or are murdered.
Yeah, let's dive into that. When you say the stereotype, what do you mean?
Well, I mean that somehow she deserved it, that it's her fault, that she was out drinking or in the wrong place, that she was in a violent relationship, which was her fault.
A lot of victim blaming.
Yeah, a lot of victim blaming. And this was not that. So I saw an opportunity there.
As a reminder to our listeners, Savannah at the time was 22 years old and about 8 months pregnant and just about to move into an apartment with her longtime boyfriend when she had been lured into a neighbor's apartment, that of Brooke Cruz and William Hain, both of whom are in prison for many charges related to this crime. Can we go into this when you say a word like stereotype, and we've already mentioned that this happens to Indigenous women at much higher than the national average. What are some of the main factors why there is something that we talk about called missing and murdered Indigenous women? Why is this group so vulnerable?
I think it just goes back historically to when white settlers came to America and began spreading across the country and displacing and erasing Native Americans. And there are several massacres in Native American history where Native American women and children are specifically targeted for violence. And the reason for this is because Native women were really considered sacred in tribal societies. And so to attack a woman was to sort of directly attack the tribe itself, because women carried on the family and the tribe through birth, as well as through their roles as equal partners with their partners. So this is really an historic problem that has been going on for hundreds of years. And it is really no different than it was before in some respects. It's just that we don't really notice Native Americans in our society, and we don't really, I think there's this term that's called invisible, mm-hmm. to describe Native Americans. And it's, I think that says a lot of it too, that most Americans just really aren't aware of what's going on with Native Americans.
Yeah, the use of the word invisible, you write in the book, the police department in Fargo, North Dakota, which has a fairly sizable Native American population, was typical. If a victim's race was not indicated, the city's record system defaults to white. So you make this argument in the book that Indigenous women who are missing and murdered disappear not just once, but three times in life, in the media coverage, and then again in the data. Have you seen changes since 2017?
I have seen a lot of changes, and I've seen a lot of changes for several reasons. And one of them is because of Savannah. Her case, because of the horrific circumstances and because so many tribes and also the community in Fargo came together to search for her while she was still missing, and just the nature of the crime itself, it got a lot of regional attention. And so at the time, the senator for North Dakota was Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat, and she had very good relationships with several tribes in North Dakota. And when this happened with Savannah and she was found murdered, Heidi Heitkamp co-authored she launched a bill called Savannah's Act. And that bill would, for the very first time, track cases of missing and murdered Native American women and girls. And it would require the federal government to collect this information and also do a report every year to Congress. So just that alone really set in motion some other things. At the same time, there were two Native American women for the first time in Congress, including Deb Haaland, our Interior Secretary. And when she was representing New Mexico, MMIW was one of her signature issues. So when she became Interior Secretary, she went ahead and pushed ahead with this law that she had authored. It was called the Not Invisible Act when she was in Congress. And this law would also address the data problem. But beyond that, it would also bring together federal authorities, law enforcement. And for the very first time, Native families and survivors to come up with recommendations for how to solve this ongoing crisis. So that is actually happening now as I speak. The commission has 40 members, including Ruth Buffalo from North Dakota, who is in my book. And it's going around to, it just was in, the commissioners were just in Alaska meeting with Alaska tribal chiefs and families. And they're coming to California in about another week and a half to meet with Northern California tribes. So I also see a lot of MMIW in terms of literature. I see a lot more literature and memoirs being published by Native American writers. And I just think that's so encouraging.
We're visiting today with Mona Gabel. She is the author of the book Searching for Savannah, The Murder of One Native American Woman and the Violence Against the Many. This is an account of the murder and aftermath of 22-year-old pregnant Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. Talking about the difficulty, Mona, of prosecuting these crimes, in talking about tracking this and in federal stats, one of the big sticking points for different acts to pass Congress is this provision that allows tribes to prosecute non-Indians for domestic violence on tribal lands. And oftentimes this violence comes at the hands of whites or non-Indigenous men. Can you remind our listeners or let our listeners know of how difficult and convoluted these cases get to be when we're talking tribal police, state police, federal police, and if the perpetrators are Native or non-Native?
Yes, it's really incredibly complicated, and this ties into why jurisdictional issues are such a problem when these cases arise. There was a Supreme Court decision in the early 1970s that basically outlawed the ability of tribes and tribal judges and tribal law enforcement to prosecute cases against non-Indian perpetrators. And Native women American advocates have been fighting that ever since, because what would happen is a young woman would disappear on a reservation, and there might be one tribal officer on the entire reservation who would be dispatched to try and find her. And in the meantime, the federal government would have, the FBI would have authority over the reservation. Mm. So often the FBI and federal authorities would not take a case because there wasn't enough evidence, or there just was not anything that they felt that they could do. And I think it's also just historic, you know, there's racism involved too, that it just doesn't matter somehow that women have disappeared. Hmm. So the families are the ones who often have ended up looking for their loved ones, like Savannah's family did, and organizing search parties. And when it comes to prosecuting these cases, they just, very few ever get prosecuted. And the other issue is that tribal courts and law enforcement just have not had the resources to deal with these cases. So they end up falling through the cracks in a lot of different ways.
I want to talk, Mona, about the structure of the book, because so often when you read or even just the rise in true crime podcasts sort of play into this sort of whatever it is about human psychology that we want to, you know, dig into salacious details of crimes. But your book tries really hard to just talk about Savannah and her family and her relationship as just a happy, wonderful, nervous, anxious, excited, full human being. Why was that so important to you?
That's always important to me, no matter who I'm writing about. But in this case, I felt because the issue had not gotten the attention that it deserved. And I just kind of fell in love with Savannah and who she was. She was very warm and funny, and she was devoted to her family. And she was also an incredibly hard worker. She, when she was living with her family, she was working full time as a certified nursing assistant at a assisted living facility in Fargo. And before that, she had been working at one in Devil's Lake before the family moved to Fargo. And she was just devoted, devoted to her patients, devoted to doing the best job she could. And she was so looking forward to the birth of her baby and to moving in with Ashton, and they're really starting their life together. So I just, that just really struck me, and I really wanted to emphasize that, I mean, she could be anybody's daughter, really. I mean, I have a daughter who is in her late 20s, and I identified with Neberta Graywind on some level, and feeling like, well, what if that were to happen to my daughter? And I wouldn't want her portrayed in this salacious way. I would, you know, I would want to know who she was. That was one of my biggest intentions in writing the book, was really to try and give readers a sense of who she was.
Yeah. How did you get the family to talk to you?
It took a long, long time. And I tend to go very slowly as a journalist when I'm trying to interview people. If they're not interested right away, I just back off. And I found that in these cases where it's super sensitive and the family was getting national attention, and they were a very private family. And this was just really awful for them on so many levels, including the level of having their privacy invaded. So I was I tried to be very sensitive to that. So as time went on, and I went to Fargo several times, and so they got to see me, and I had introduced myself to them, and I was working on a magazine article first before I wrote the book. And eventually the prosecutors who I developed a close relationship with, they essentially introduced me to the family, and then they finally said they would talk to me. So that was really important in writing the book, as well as the magazine piece. It's just developing trust with them.
And have you stayed in touch? There are parts of the book that do seem to indicate that after a while they just didn't want to talk about this anymore.
Exactly. I've been in touch with them, and but they did tell me that they really wanted to just continue living their lives and try and rebuild their lives with Hazley Joe. And I was, you know, I respected that. So I just again, we stay in touch, but I didn't do many interviews with them after that.
Mona Gabel is the author of Searching for Savannah, The Murder of One Native American Woman and the Violence Against the Many. You can find out more about Mona at mona-gabel.com. Mona, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
More Main Street after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are going to learn now about the poet Bruce Roseland. This is from Poetry from Studio 47, which comes to us from Patrick Hicks. He is a writer in residence and member of the English faculty at Augustana University in Sioux Falls.
Roseland was born in Faulkton, South Dakota on November 5, 1951. He grew up on his family's ranch, and after completing high school, he went to South Dakota State University, where he majored in sociology. Roseland transferred to the University of North Dakota, where he received his BA. He then went to study for an MA, also in sociology, and also from UND, which he received in 1980. After being away from the family ranch for so long, Roseland decided to return to Seneca, South Dakota, in order to run it. In doing so, he became the fourth generation of his family to work the land. Roseland is known as a cowboy poet, which means that his topics often include observations about ranching life. Most cowboy poets usually worked with a fixed rhyme scheme. Their topics are often realistic and grounded in nature. I find the term cowboy poet limiting and even marginalizing. For me, good poetry is good poetry. Perhaps there is a snootiness in American culture, a snootiness that says the world of agriculture can't create good art. We could certainly have a very rich discussion about this, about how art from the Midwest and the West is usually considered not as important as what is being created on the coasts. That, however, is a discussion for another time. Roseland's books include The Last Buffalo, A Song for My Mother, A Prairie Prayer, and Cowman. He has won the Wrangler Award from the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, as well as the Will Rogers Medallion Award. In fact, he has won this award twice. He lives in Seneca, South Dakota. Today's poem is titled Moonshine. After telling you that cowboy poets usually use strong rhyme schemes, Roseland doesn't. In fact, he writes in free verse, and most of his poems are a single stanza in length. What I really like about our poem for today is the topic. I've lived in a number of cities in my life, Chicago, London, Belfast, Barcelona, and while I love these places, I'm always reminded of the light pollution that blots out the stars. Being away from the city, being in the prairie or in the woods, means seeing the night sky anew. The sky is absolutely salted with stars, and a full moon can illuminate the darkest field. As Roseland reminds us, we lose something by being in our big, bright cities. This is Moonshine, by Bruce Roseland. There is always something mystical about a sky lighted by moonshine. Stars are present, but gentler. Clouds floating across the night sky are a translucent white. The moonlit earth can be traveled about without need of any additional light. I have stood in the middle of my yard and read a newspaper by moonshine. When was it that we became afraid of the dark, like death, hiding in our cities of light? In doing so, we lost that half of the night that is moonshine. With the full moon upon the countryside, it's easy to imagine walking out, striding over the land, disappearing into the shadows to find the mystery that you know has always been on the very edge of your life. Find a road. Follow the moonshine.
That was Patrick Hicks reading Moonshine by Bruce Roseland. Poetry from Studio 47 is recorded at Augustana University and is produced by Peter Folliard. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
The U.S. has only until next Thursday to raise the debt ceiling or risk default and its economic consequences. But personal finance experts still have two words of advice for small investors. Don't panic.
Really fight your worst instinct to act on the news.
The importance of keeping calm and carrying on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 24th. The front page of the Fargo Forum on this date in 1918 was covered with news about World War I. On the very bottom was a tiny announcement that two boys from North Dakota were going to enter West Point, Frank Henning Jr. of Lakota and Sidney Hines of Wahpeton. Frank Henning Jr. was born in Lakota in 1896.
He attended the North Dakota Agricultural College before enrolling at West Point. When the United States entered World War I, West Point accelerated their program in order to send more officers to the front. So Frank ended up graduating early in 1920. He served in Hawaii, taught military science at Purdue, and then taught at the U.S. Army Field Artillery School. During World War II, Frank was in the planning and equipment branch of the War Department. He later became the commanding general of the 71st Division Artillery and was promoted to brigadier general in 1944. Frank earned a Legion of Merit, Bronze Star, and Commendation Ribbon during his service. Frank passed away in 1983 and is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Sidney Hines was the other North Dakota boy entering West Point in 1918. Sidney was born in Newton, Illinois in 1900 and went to high school in Wahpeton. Sidney excelled in marksmanship. He was so good that he made the Olympic national shooting team, competing at the Olympics in Paris in 1924. The day before his event, a Belgian contestant dropped his gun and shot Sidney in the foot. In spite of this, Sidney won a gold medal in shooting the following day. During World War II, he commanded the 41st Armored Infantry Regiment, which invaded Africa, went through Sicily, sailed to England, invaded France, then fought all the way to Berlin. Sidney was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, the Legion of Merit, 4 Silver Stars, 3 Bronze Stars, 2 Commendation Ribbons, and the Purple Heart. He was promoted to Brigadier General in 1945. After retiring from the Army in 1947, Sidney worked for the United Nations in Geneva and in South Korea. He died in 1991 and is buried in Fort Sam Houston National Cemetery. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor-Sturza. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
This is Ari Shapiro from NPR. If working from home is your new routine and you've got a car you don't need anymore, consider donating it to this station. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you.
Just go to prairiepublic.org, open the support tab, and choose Vehicle Donation.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, artificial intelligence. How should it be regulated? This conversation happening the same week as AI-generated images faked an explosion at the Pentagon. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.